Have you ever been in a situation and you've just kind of stopped to say, okay, Yahweh, where are you? Yep. Seriously, right? I know I'm not the only one. You ever been in a situation and you're just like, okay, Yahweh, I know you said you'd never leave me, you'd never forsake me, but where are you? I want to share some things today regarding Purim, and it's the same type of scenario. You know, in the story of Purim, the whole book, as you read through the book of Esther, the name of Yahweh is not mentioned once, but there is no denying there's no denying that he's working, and there's no denying that he's delivering his people, but his name's not there. So what can that teach? What can that help us with? Because there are times in life when we feel like, okay, Yahweh, where are you? He hasn't left you. He said, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you, and that's true. But there are times we need to go through and experience certain things. And then there are some times that he wants us to do some things for his glory. There are some times he wants to work things through our life for his glory, for his benefit. Like scripture says, may people see your good works, your good deeds, and praise your Father. So there are some times that we need to do something that the Father has put us or allowed us to be in situations so that he can. And sometimes we don't really see that. Sometimes it's hard to see that and understand that. Sometimes you got to go through something and look back on it to be able to say, oh yeah, there he was, right? And then sometimes we may never see it. We may never understand it. It doesn't mean it. Consider, from the time Yahweh made covenant with Avraham, from the time Yahweh spoke to Avraham, till the time that what he told him would happen, it took 430 years. Think about that for a moment. From the time he told Avraham, not just, I will give you a son, even that, it took 25 years for that to happen. He said, I'm going to give you a son. Then he said, your descendants will be as numerous as the stars of the sky, right? And he said that your descendants will go into a land that is not theirs, and they will become oppressed, but I will judge those who have oppressed them, right? That happened. Well, guess what? From the time it was told to Abraham till the time it happened, 430 years. In that midst of that 430 years, do you think someone said, God, where are you? Matter of fact, as we open, we read the story of Exodus. We read that that was the cry that went up to the heavens. That was the cry that Yahweh heard. He heard the oppression of his people. He heard their cries, and he came down to them. Sometimes we just need to have faith and hope that he is working because he said that he. And Purim is a good example of that. So we're going to go a little bit of the backstory in regards to Purim and kind of talk about it a little bit because it is coming up in a few weeks. And so we do want to acknowledge what is happening in there. Now, Purim, again, Purim is not one of the festivals in Leviticus 23 that you find of the commanded Moedim that we're told we need to observe. But much like Hanukkah, is it ever a bad idea to give thanks to Yahweh that he delivered you? That's the purpose and that's the intent. And you even have of the different offerings that were brought. A Thanksgiving offering was a big one, wasn't it? So again, it's just a matter of it. And many of us will do the same thing. If we make it through something, we commemorate the day. You know, we memorialize that day. And every year we're like, you know, it was this many years ago today that Yahweh did this for me. That's not a bad idea, guys, because it's good to remember the things that the Father has done for you. Now, the idea is obviously to continue to look forward to, because we can also get stuck in yesterday. You ever done that? You get stuck in yesterday and you can't move forward. See, and so, or you get stuck in just someday that you forget to stop to see what he's doing in your life today. See, Yahweh wants us to remember and acknowledge the things that he has done for us. He wants to acknowledge the things that he said that he would do for us, but we also need to acknowledge what he's doing in our midst in our lives. He is the God of who. And so in every aspect of our life, we acknowledge him. So even in those times when it doesn't seem like he's there. Maybe he's asking us. And we know that that's kingdom life too, isn't it? How many times do we say, okay, Yahweh, you said that you would do this, but we don't want to have any part in doing it. And how much of the scripture is Yahweh telling us, much like caring for one another, helping each other, you know, helping the community, doing these type of things. He said he would care for his people, but he does that through you. And so all of us working together thrives. So, little backstory before we get into that, okay? You familiar with the main characters in the story, if you will, to put it that way? We have Esther. By the way, you know her name, was it? What's the name Esther mean? Covered over. Her name was Hadassah, and her name was Esther because her identity was. And so we have Esther, we have Mordecai, and we have Haman. Not yet. Always have fun. So before we get into that, let's give a little backstory on this, okay? So first off, Haman was an Agagite. What does that mean? We'll look into that and see. Agag was the king of Amalek. So you could say Purim was an attack from Amalek against the Jews. And what this means is that, see, Amalek, what did Amalek do? Amalek wanted to wipe out Israel. And that's what Haman wanted, and to wipe out the people. And if you look throughout history, you can see that spirit has rose its ugly head time and again to wipe out the people. But that's what's happened. What the story is about, and dare I say, we even see some of that still in the earth today. But this is what was going on. Purim was an attack from Amalek. So how can I say that? And what was the attack from Amalek and what happened there? To do that, we need to go back. Before we can talk about Esther, we need to go back and talk about that. Okay, take a look at it. Go back to Exodus 17:8. It says, Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. We're a little deeper into that in a second, but remember at Rephidim, when Israel had come out of Mitzrayim, and they go and they come into the wilderness, and there's 3 days, and some things start happening. We'll cover that in just a second. So what goes on? Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 19. Again, just talking about him attacking at Rephidim. It says, remember what Amalek, see in Exodus 17:8, we read about it happening. And in Devarim, Moshe is telling the people of Israel to remember this, because when you're going into the land, this is important for you. So Devarim 25, 17, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, and the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. So what is the backstory? They're in the wilderness right after leaving Mitzrayim. I mean, consider. So they go through, they come to the water. They just went through the Sea of Reeds, and here they are. Pharaoh and those who pursued them were washed over. And so now they're free. They're excited. They're yelling. They're singing praises to Yahweh, declaring his goodness. And 3 days later, they're grumbling and complaining. Don't look bad. Don't look down at them, because some of us, it wouldn't take 3 days. 3 days later, they're grumbling and complaining. What happened? Exodus 15, 22 to 24. So Moshe brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out to the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness, and they what? Found no. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And when the people murmured against Moshe, saying, what shall we drink? So I want to point something out here. It says he brought them through, and they came to Marah. Marah means bitter. The place was named bitter because of the bitterness. But the way this reads in the Hebrew literally reads this. It says, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah because they were bitter. It does not read, they couldn't drink from the waters of Marah because the waters were bitter. It said they couldn't drink from the water because they, it doesn't say the water. Consider, the water was acting as a mirror. The water was reflecting their personality, their current circumstance. As they looked to the water, it was a reflection of what was going on within them as they approached the water. Because when we look at this, recap, 3 days into the wilderness, they found no water. They're bitter, they're grumbling, they're complaining. And then it says they couldn't drink from the water because they were bitter. And the people murmured against Moshe saying, what shall we drink? Right? Notice they never actually come to Moshe and ask the question. They always come to him like aggressively. They never just say, hey, Moses, are you aware of the situation? You know, they're always like, great, Moses, you brought us out here to die again, right? Okay, so this is what's going on. Now consider this. What's the deal with water? Okay, if you're in the wilderness in a desert, how much do you need? You need water. You need water anyway, even more so when you're in a desert, okay? You ever spend time in a desert? It's hot and dry. We were in Israel. We went to go see the area where how long do you think? Now, they're not just casually strolling. 3 days of, okay, let's hoof it, guys. Come on, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. 3 days. So they were bitter, and they grumbled, and they were complaining. And so when they got to the water, Yahweh is reminding them of their current state, reminding them of what he is doing for them. He says, I'm delivering you, I'm doing these things. Don't have that kind of attitude or that kind of heart when you come before him. He says that he would take care of them. He promised them before he brought them out, he would take care of them. Okay? So they just needed to be mindful of that. So what happens? Water is supposed to sustain life, right? Again, what was bitter? The water or the people? Consider this. If you are bitter, your heart is bitter. If you are bitter, you will approach what was intended to give life and you will see bitterness. Can I phrase it the way that it says it in the scripture? If you are bitter, when you approach the word of Yahweh, you won't approach it with, you will approach it resentfully. And you're not going to read about a caring, loving God who cares for his people, calling us to a place of covenant and wants us to walk with him out of love for him. Your heart reflects how you receive what is. So this is what they were doing when they came to the water. Their spiritual state was reflected in the water and it revealed them. So let's take a look at the story. Exodus 17, 1 through 8. So all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of Yahweh, and they camped at Rephidim. There was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moshe and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moshe said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test Yahweh?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moshe. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt? To kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Okay. Verse 4, so Moshe cried to Yahweh, "What shall I do with this people? They're ready to stone me." I bet they were. And Yahweh said to Moshe, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." And Moshe did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Verse 7, and he called the name of the place Massa and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, because they tested Yahweh by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" And then Amalek came. Amalek came right after Massa and Meribah, right after them. So what happens? We see the people quarreled with Moshe, demanding, "Give us water to drink." And Moshe replied, "Why pick a fight with me? You're testing Yahweh, right?" He's like, "Why pick a fight with me? You're not picking a fight with me. You're picking a fight with God, right?" And down here, verses 5 and 6, Yahweh said to Moshe, "Go on before the people and take the elders of Israel and your rod." You know, a couple years ago, I saw it first time. I never really noticed it before. He said, when you strike the rock at Horeb, you do so with the elders of Israel. It wasn't like all Israel. It's like the elders that went there with the rock. And then he struck the rock, water came out. And I kind of feel it was a responsibility of the elders to make sure that water got to the people, that they were supposed to do that. Like, this goes along with the idea of setting up leaders over tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. So they go and they strike the rock in Horeb, in the sight of the elders of Israel. And so what happens? Yahweh told Moshe about the rock and how he would give the water, but the grumbling and the quarreling and all of these things opened up the doorway for what comes next. The people said, "Is Yahweh with us or not?" And then Amalek came and fought with Israel. They got to a place because of their current circumstance where they said, "Is God with us or not?" Because, I'm going to oversimplify it, life wasn't going the way that they thought. How many times have we done? When life doesn't go the way that we tell God it needs to go, we say God's not with us. Is God with us or not? Thing. He said he was. We need to follow him. We can't jump off the trail, trying to blaze our own trail and saying, "Come on, Yahweh, let's go this way." We follow him. He said he would never leave us or forsake us. And so they were at this place because of doubt. And what did they doubt? Did they doubt Yahweh or did they doubt their expectation of Yahweh? Because a lot of us have done the same thing, even in the process of setting up golden calves. We put Yahweh in a box and say, "This is the God that I serve. And this is what he does. And this is how I receive him. And this is what happens. And if anything happens outside of that box, well, that's just not." We can't do that. You can't put Yahweh. And so we need to trust him. Even when things don't go the way, especially. That's the whole idea of having doubt will open the door. Why do you think doubt seems to be the opposite of, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, right? How much doubt do you? That's why scripture says, let's go on a couple of things. Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 18. So remember what Amalek did to you in the way when you came out of Egypt, how he met you by the way and smote the hindmost of you, even all those that were feeble behind you when you were faint and weary and he feared not God. So the word that for feeble is hashal. And you know, when you read through the scripture, it says when they came out of Mitzrayim, there was none feeble among them. They all had strength and vigor and they could walk and they could do this, right? They were all healthy. So what does this mean right here? If they were all healthy and they were all had their strength, what does this mean? Because it says that they were weak, they were feeble, but the word for that means unsteady. I'm going to paraphrase it this double mind, unsteady, like not sure. And remember when he brought him out, he said, "When I bring him out, I'm going to bring him out this way, which is not the shortest way, because if they go that way, they're immediately going to see war, and they're not ready for that." But he says they were perfectly equipped for everything they needed. So if they were equipped, why couldn't they go to war? They had everything they needed to do it, but they didn't know how to use it, and they didn't have the faith required to go into that. He put them in the situation where they would have to have faith in him, right? Who were unsteady. Not the ones right in the midst of the tabernacle. Not the ones with their focus towards the tabernacle. Not the ones, and granted, I know, you know, at the time when he attacked the tabernacle, okay? But here's the point that I'm making. not the ones who were pursuing his. James 1:5-8, if any of you lack wisdom, let him do what? Let him ask of God. That gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given to him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavers is like the wave of the sea driven in the wind and tossed. For let not that man think he will receive anything from the Lord, because a double-minded man. So don't be double-minded. You can say, Yahweh, I trust you, but only this far. Trust him. So then we also know that the attacks came when the people were weary and tired. How many of us have say, well, that sounds fun, right? When does the adversary bring attacks against you? When you feel confident, that's what happened. We're at a place of needing to be lifted up, have their eyes turned back to the Father to say, don't do what you're doing. Avert your eyes to the situation and look to the Father. He's going to deliver you. And that's what we find here, doubt and double-mindedness, what led them. So what causes doubt and double-mindedness? And like I said, there's a lot of different things we can say, but kind of at the small part of that, well, when we don't understand something, and how many of us can, okay, so when we don't understand something, it can open up that door for doubt, and that's the temptation. Will we doubt, or will we? Deuteronomy 25:18, he said, and he killed those who were straggling behind. The word for straggling behind is achar, which means also to procrastinate. These are ones, what were they procrastinating in? Following you? So these are ones, so the ones who were here are the ones who doubted and procrastinate, tailing behind, and they're following. And consider this, a lack of faith will delay you moving. Doubt will attack. We need to have faith. Asking questions is, okay, all of us have questions. There are times we just say, Yahweh, I don't understand. And we ask the questions. There's nothing wrong with asking a question, but don't let doubt have faith. So I want to show you something interesting here, because there's a connection between Amalek and doubt. In the Hebrew, the word Amalek and doubt, if you're familiar with the Hebrew at all, you know that the Hebrew alphabet, each letter has a number that is equated to go with it. Like example, if we say, if we're reading a book and we say chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, in Hebrew they wouldn't go chapter 1, 2, 3, they would do chapters aleph, bet. So each Hebrew letter has it. Well, the word for doubt and Amalek have the same value, which is to me nothing more, but it shows a kind of a, when we doubt, and if we allow Amalek to come in, so it says the Hebrew that Amalek encountered you, or he attacked you, he encountered you. The Hebrew is karcha. Karcha can also be read as he cooled you off. The word kar is, so it says he encountered you can also be read like he cooled you off. You're no longer on your lack of faith, your doubt. When you came out 3 days ago, you were excited. 3 days in the wilderness, you're not so excited now. But I thought when we came out, it was just going to be this great, awesome time and this awesome party, and 3 days in the wilderness. What's going on? Guess what, guys? Yahweh never promised you. Anyone who tells you, give your life to the Father and everything will just be okay, is lying to you. It's not going to get easier. Although, you will have, and you can find joy, and you will have promises you can hold on to. It does get better. So the word there, so he encountered you, can also be read as, don't allow the circumstances of life. Have faith. Look to him. Even when you don't recognize the absence, you're feeling that he's okay. Okay, with that, so Purim. Haman wanted to kill Mordecai. Why? Mordecai was a Jew. Actually, he was from the tribe of Benjamin. Just as an interesting side note, who else was from the tribe of Benjamin that we read about in the Brit Hadashah? Paul. So here we have Haman who wanted to kill Mordecai, and he saw an opportunity to attack the Jewish people, okay? And so they cast lots to determine when. So casting lots, it's they had like bones or what we, kind of the equivalent of what we'd say dice to determine the fate. He's saying, is this the month I get to do something against the Jews? And they would cast a lot. What he was doing, waiting for the opportune time of chance to be on his side so that he could bring a plot against. So Esther, like I said, whose name means hidden, reveals the plot to the king. And that's kind of what we, I'm going to jump through this really quick, but I encourage you before Purim, read the book of Esther. It's not a big book. It's not extremely long. Read it. And I guarantee you Hollywood doesn't do it. It's just an amazing book to read into, okay? So Esther 6. So that night, the king couldn't sleep. So he ordered the records of the daily journal brought, and they were read to the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told about an assassination plot. The king asked how he was thanked, and he was told nothing was done for him. Now remember, Haman has a plot coming to where he wants to kill all the Jewish people, right? And especially Mordecai, right? And we hear that Mordecai stopped a plot to poison the king, right? So what's happening? So Haman came into the outer courtyard of the king's palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai. because he made a gallows for him already. He's persistent. So what happens? So the king says, oh, great, Haman's here. Have him come in. And so as soon as he comes in, the king says to Haman, what should be done for the man that the king wants to honor? And knowing what we know about Haman, how do you think he responded to this? He walks in and says, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? Haman's like, oh, me? Me? Really? So Haman says to the king, oh, for the man the king wants to honor. So Haman answered, for a man the king wants to honor, have royal robes brought, which the king himself wears, and the horse the king himself rides with a royal crown on his head, and the robes and the horse should be handed over to one of the king's most respected officials, and they should put the robes on the man, and the king wants to honor and lead him on horseback through the streets of the city and proclaiming ahead of him, this is what is done for the man whom the king wants to honor. And so the king says to Haman, I like that idea. That sounds real. I want you to hurry. I want you to take the robes. I want you to take the horse and do exactly as what you have said for Mordecai. I want you to do it for Mordecai, the one that he came to see the king to have hanged. Well, that didn't go well, did it? So what happens? So he goes and do this, goes for Mordecai the Jew, sits at the king's gate, and don't leave anything out, you men. So now he has to go through parading Mordecai on the king's horse in the king's royal robes, saying, this is what is to be done for the man whom the king wants to honor. So now Esther has this banquet, because she's heard about this plot that Mordecai, that Haman. So Esther actually has two banquets for the king and Haman. And the king asks for Haman had the king. How can I put this? There isn't a delicate way to put it. Signing a decree that on this day, it is your responsibility within the kingdom to attack all. So Esther tries to get the king to kind of show a little favor here to the king. She invites the king and Haman, trying to figure out, how am I gonna work this out? So Esther says, if I won favor, king, and if it pleases the king, then what I ask be given me is my life and the lives of my... And the king Ahasuerus asks Esther, so who is he? Where is the man who dares to do such a thing? Who is the man who dares to threaten my queen? A wicked man. Him. Wow. I mean, if you read through the whole story, as you're going, like I said, Hollywood does not do this. So he says, this wicked Haman, and Haman stood aghast, terrified before the king and the queen. Remember, they didn't know who she was, her identity. They did not know she was a Jew. So what happens now? So in a rage, the king got up from the wine banquet, and he went out to the palace garden, but Haman remained pleading for his life with Esther to the queen to spare him, for he could see that the king had decided to do him in. And Haman had just fallen on the couch where Esther was when the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet, and he shouted, is this man even going to rape the queen here in the palace before my very eyes? Ooh, it went from bad to worse, right? And so this moment these words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harvana, one of the king's attendants, said, oh, hey, look, there's a gallows 75 feet high that Haman made for Mordecai. You remember the one who saved you? And the king said, all right, hang him on it. So what do you think happened to Haman? Hang him on the gallows. He had prepared for Mordecai and he subsided, but that's not the end of the story. So King Ahasuerus says to Esther, the queen, and Mordecai, the Jew, listen, I gave Esther the house of Haman and they hanged him on the gallows because he threatened the lives of the Jews. You should issue a decree in the king's name for whatever you want concerning the Jews and seal it with the king's signet ring, because a decree written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring cannot be rescinded by anyone. Once he made the decree that this was what was going to happen, he couldn't just say, oh, I take it back. So how are they going to fix the situation? How are they going to remedy everyone going to turn on at this time? So they sent letters, and the letters said that the king had granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and defend their lives by destroying, killing, and exterminating any forces of any people or any province that would attack them, their little ones or their women, or would try to seize their goods as plunder. The king issued a decree saying, if you guys attack them, as I said you could earlier, just remember, they're going to defend themselves. That's a little bit of an avertment. That doesn't make it so appealing for them now, does it? So meanwhile, Mordecai left the king's presence, arrayed in royal blue and white, wearing a large gold crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan shouted for joy. For all the Jews, all was light and gladness, joy and honor. This is a decree with very messianic tones. At the time of when those who tried to attack the people of Yahweh, the plan was averted, the plan was stopped, and the people of Yahweh will be delivered again in every province, every city, where the king's order and decree, our king, where the king's order and decree had arrived. The Jews, gladness. They had gladness in commemorating their deliverance and the goodness of Yahweh. When the Messiah comes, the people of Yahweh events turned in 17. The dragon was infuriated over the woman, went to fight the rest of her children. Those who obey God's command returns, there will be a greater. The decree of the king will go forth and bring great joy. Isaiah 2:3 says, many people will go and say, come, let us go to the mountain of Adonai, to the house of the God of Yaakov, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go forth the Torah and the word of Adonai from you. Micah 4:2, many Gentiles, many from the nations, will go and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Adonai, to the house of the God of Yaakov, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go forth the Torah. Awesome stuff. So, in every province and city where the king's order decree, the Jews had gladness and joy and a feast and a holiday. And then what comes next? And many from the people of the land became Jews because of the fear of the Jews. Many people of the land who were not Israel, not from the tribe of Judah, not from Israel, decided, I'm going to join with Israel because their God is. I'm going to join with Israel. So many people of the land. It says, Adonai Sabaoth says, when the time comes, 10 men will take hold of speaking all the languages of the nations, will grab hold of the cloak of a Jew and say, we will go with you. For we've heard that God. A little deeper examination into this. Many of you know this already, but when you take a little deeper look at this, when you talk about the nations and people from the nations, because it says language of all languages and nations. So when you talk about all languages and nations, biblically speaking, most often you hear about the 70 nations. And the reason for that is the 70 descended from Noah. And you hear about that, it's the 70 nations, right? How can 10 represent all language? The only place you see that where that makes sense is where the 10 northern tribes of Israel, because of idolatry and disobedience, were scattered among the nations. And here it says, 10 men from every language, from all the nations, will grab hold of one who was a Jew. Which Jew were they grabbing hold of? Yeshua. Grabbing hold of Yeshua. And that's the idea. Those who were scattered into the nations and those who joined with them are called, becoming a people called Israel. Set out, grafted in, Roman, you used to be Gentiles, so many other things given in there. But back to our Esther 9, 1 through 10. So now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, what month are we in? Adar. On the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred, and the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout the province of King Ahasuerus, and to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen. And all the officials of the provinces, and the satraps, and the governors, and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. Verse 4, for Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. And the Jews all struck their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshadatha, and Adelphon, and Asphata, and Porata, and Adalia, and Aridatha, and, see that one, and Parmashta, and Arasal, and Aradal, and Vaisata, and the 10 sons of Haman. Now look at this one, and the 10 sons of Haman of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they. So look at this, Amalek and Saul, 1 Samuel 15, verses 2, 3, and 8, and 9. Thus says Yahweh Tzavaot, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. And verse 8, so he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Verse 8. And took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fattened calves and the lambs and all that was good, and they would not utterly destroy. So what happened here? How can we say that Haman was an Agagite? Because King Agag right here was left alive. Continued to live. He had descendants. Back to our story, Esther 9, verse 12. And the king says to Queen Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done to the rest of the king's provinces? So now what is your wish? It shall be granted you, and what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done, and a decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. Question is, if they'd already, you're talking about tomorrow, right? You know, when you're reading things about tomorrow, tomorrow can mean tomorrow or someday in prophetic language. So I want to point something out, bring out another tomorrow. January 30th, 1944, Hitler said, if the Nazis are vanquished, the Jews will be able to celebrate a special poor. Why? It's that same spirit that came against them. During World War II, the Nazis in Germany tried to wipe the Jewish race from the face of the earth. 6 million Jews were killed by the Germans, and after the end of the war, the surviving Nazi leaders were tried at Nuremberg for this and other war crimes. These trials began on November 20th, 1945. On October 1st, 1946, 12 of the German defendants were sentenced to death by hanging for their part in the atrocities committed against the Jews. One of those convicted was Martin Bormann, who was sentenced in absentia. A second was Hermann Göring, who committed suicide in his cell just hours before the executions by taking cyanide. The remaining 10, how many? The remaining 10 Germans were hanged. Dr. Moshe Katz reveals about this event. Since the trial was conducted by a military tribunal, the sentence handed down should have been read by firing squad or by electric chair in the USA. However, the court specifically prescribed hanging, exactly like Esther's original request to let Haman. So on October 1st, 1946, after 216 court sessions, the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg delivered its verdict, sentencing the leaders of the Nazi Party to death by hanging. The author of the following account, Kingsbury Smith of the International News Service, was chosen by lot to represent the American, chosen by lot, interesting, to represent the American press at the 10th, October 1946. Julius Streicher made his melodramatic appearance at 2:12 a.m. While his manacles were being removed and his bare hands bound, this ugly, dwarfish little man wearing a threadbare suit and well-worn bluish shirt buttoned to the neck, but without a tie, he was notorious for flashy dress, glanced at the three wooden scaffolds in front of him, and he glanced around the room, his eyes resting momentarily on the small group of witnesses. By this time, his hands were tied securely behind his back. Two guards, one on each arm, directed him to the number one gallows on the left of the entrance, and he walked steadily the 6 feet to the first wooden step. As the guards stopped him, at the bottom of the steps for identification formality, he uttered a piercing scream, which I'm not going to repeat. The shriek sent a shiver down my back. As its echo died away, an American colonel standing by the steps said sharply, "Ask the man." In response to the interpreter's query, Streicher shouted, "You know." The interpreter repeated his request, and the condemned man, as he reached the platform, Streicher cried out, "Now it goes to God." He was pushed the last two steps to the mortal spot beneath the hangman's rope. The rope was being held back against. Streicher was swung suddenly to face the witnesses and glared at them, and then he screamed, "Purim." It wasn't anywhere near Purim. Why would he make this? So Purim, again, Jewish holiday celebrated in the spring, commemorating the execution of Haman, an ancient persecutor. I want to show you something written. We know that as you look in the Torah scrolls, there are many things that you see in the Torah scrolls that they don't translate. It's just the way that the scrolls are written. You know, some of the things, dots and tittles. Some letters are larger, some are smaller, some are inverted. There's just different things that are written there, okay? Well, in the book of Esther, a spot written through 9, where it says, "And also he killed Shandata and Asphata," so he's going on down. You're looking at it on the right-hand side, you have the names on the left-hand side, Va'et, which means on and on and on. So this is how it is written in the scroll in Megillah Esther. So Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa allow tomorrow to do according to this day's edict. Let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. So again, if Haman's 10 sons had already been killed, sages come in on the word tomorrow in Esther's request. This is a tomorrow that is now, and there's a tomorrow that is later. In other words, you could say prophetically, it is to come, or someday. So the strange formatting, the Cincino commentary states this: "The master prescribes that the names of the 10 sons of Haman be written in a perpendicular column on the right-hand side of the page with the Vav, the and, on the left-hand side." This is probably derived from the tradition that the 10 sons were hanged on the tall gallows of the other. The three letters that are written smaller in the script, I didn't know if you noticed that, the three letters that are written smaller, the Taf of Parshandata, the Shin of Parmasata, and the Zayin of Vizata, those three letters together, the Taf, Shin, Zayin, is how they would say the Jewish year 5707, which corresponds to 1940. Interesting. So Purim was a victory over those who sought to destroy the people, Jewish people. Are others asked to remember and celebrate the victory? We see constantly and time again how this was. Esther 9:17. "So on the 13th day of the month of Adar, they rested and made it a holiday for celebrating and rejoicing. However, the Jews of Shushan assembled on both the 13th and the 14th days of Adar. So it was on the 15th day they rested and made it a holiday for celebrating and..." So this is why the Jews of the villages, those who live in the unwalled towns, made the 14th day of the month of Adar a day for celebrating and rejoicing, a holiday and a time for sending each other portions of food. And Mordecai recorded these events and sent letters to all the Jews in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, instructing them to what? Observe the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day every year. So this was a memorial that they were taking upon themselves to establish the people of Yahweh will remain. Those who come against, no matter what happens, no matter how many of the world or the adversary tries to come against, Yahweh will. So to commemorate the days on which the Jews obtained rest from their enemies and the month for which was turned from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, they were to make them days of celebrating and rejoicing, sending portions of food to each other and giving gifts to the poor. So the Jews took it upon themselves to continue what they had already begun to do and as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman the son of Hamdatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had thrown poor. That's Purim. That's where we get them from. Purim is plural. They had cast lots to crush. But when Esther came before the king, he ordered by letters that Haman's wicked scheme, which he had plotted against the Jews, should recoil on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. This is why these days have been called Purim, after the word poor. Thus, because everything that is written in this letter and what they had seen concerning this matter, so the Jews resolved and took it upon themselves and their descendants and all who might join them. Who are those all who might join them? Those who are grafted in among them. That without fail, they would observe these 2 days in accordance with what was written in this letter at the appointed time every year. And these days will be remembered and observed throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city, and that these days of Purim would never cease among the Jews or their memory be lost by their descendants. And then Esther, the queen, the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai the Jew, gave full written authority to confirm a second letter about Purim, and he sent copies of it to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, ensuring peace and security, requiring the observance of these days of Purim at their designated times, as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they established for themselves and their descendants concerning the matters of fasting, and at Esther's own were confirmed and put in writing in a book. That's the story of Purim. So the question, should we acknowledge it? Should we? At the very least, it is a commemoration like we started off at the beginning. Even when you don't, his name is not anywhere in the book of Esther, but yet you know as you read through the story, he is doing things. He is coordinating events. He is coordinating things to happen. And at the right time, he put the right people in the right places to do the right thing. He who watches over you is the apple of his eye. And in the midst of trial, in the midst of whatever life may bring, and in all things we acknowledge he is the one who, Yahweh still delivers. Yahweh still heals. Yahweh still restores as a people who, not for us, amen,